The new Starz series, Mary and George, starring Julianne Moore and Nicholas Galitzine, tells a story almost too outrageous to be true. But shockingly, it is. With next to nothing to her name and looking to elevate her social standing, Mary Villiers sets her handsome and charming son George on the path to seduce King James I and become his all-powerful lover. The show is full of wit, scandal, action. You won't be able to look away. Watch the season premiere of Mary and George now, only on Starz and the Starz app.
I'm Jenna Wortham.
And I'm Wesley Morris. We're two culture writers at the New York Times.
When I'm not busy reclaiming my time, I mostly write about how humans relate to technology.
And I mostly write about how movies and popular culture and such relate to humans.
This is Still Processing. Ba-da-ba. Welcome back to our show, our pop culture confession booth.
Hello.
So it's on your bucket list this week.
Well, okay. I'm just going to throw this out there because I think a lot of people are having a similar problem. Every house I've ever been to has this. It's the what people call the utility drawer, that drawer in your kitchen that has rubber bands and screws and braces and menus and a bunch of other stuff you never ever use except one time a year when you need the one thing in that like drawer of mess. Make the drawer go away. This is my goal for the summer. That drawer is leaving my house. It is just going to be empty. It is going to be a memorial drawer to the utility crap drawer that it used to be. I think everybody should think about doing that this summer. I actually want to know what other people have in that drawer because I think it's simultaneously amusing and horrifying. It's a total drawer gone to total waste. Solve your utility drawer, people. Sam Shepard died. In addition to being a fine actor, was one of America's greatest playwrights. I just am so struck by his legacy and his explorations of masculinity and how that sort of has been misapprehended by other artists. And I think he was such an original talent, and the things he was exploring were so specific and native to him that they didn't, as much as they commented on American life, were also these commentaries and these therapy sessions for himself. Basically, my point is people who want to be Sam Shepard, do not try that at home.
Noted.
And lastly, I'm in a really bad mood about this Confederate business.
Mm.
The HBO show that was announced last week, I am trying to figure out where the wrongness line is. I'm not actually opposed to its existence. I just don't know why you'd want to do it. I don't have an answer, but I would like to talk to you about trying to arrive at one at some point, if that's possible.
Of course.
What's going on with you?
Well, this weekend I went to see the new Spider-Man movie.
And yes!
I really loved it. So Spider-Man Homecoming was directed by John Watts. And, you know, a lot for the last couple of years, these big superhero movies have been really morose, really depressing, really dark looks at, you know, these tormented existential questions of what does it mean to be a lone man against the world, trying to save it from itself. And
yes,
this movie did away with all of that. It very much was super lighthearted and fun, followed Peter Parker as a high school student, super goofy, a lot of like social media. There are a lot of great cameos, including one by Zendaya, who's a former Disney star. The movie itself is very inclusive feeling. There's a couple of classmates in hijabs and there's a lot of brown students. I mean, it's it feels like a well-rounded film. I mean, it's, you know, like the main person is still just like a young white dude. So it's like, don't give them too many props. But I don't know. It was just a very nice antidote to the superhero fatigue I've been feeling in general. And so I was very happy to go. And it was a great watch.
Yes.
I also want to shout out the Moon app, which is just the Moon app.
Yes!
In the iTunes store, which just tells you where the moon is at in its various lunar cycle. And so it'll be like, today it's a waxing crescent or whatever. And as someone who always tries to orient the moon in the sky, it's also nice to have a little thing on my phone that tells me exactly where it is in its cycle. And I think about where my body is in its cycle. And this app in particular is really cute because it sends you little updates like, hey girl, it's like, you know that feeling half full, half empty? Me too. And it's like halfway. It's like a funny, it turns the moon into a cute little Pixar character. I just enjoy it very much. So everyone should check it out. It's cute. It's free. It's a lot of fun. Wesley, in our continued search and our continued quest to think about what the song of the summer might be, I have to tell you that there's a new contender.
Mm-mm.
I've heard this song at the beach, in the grocery store, coming off of people's bikes. It has a good beat. I've been using the lyrics as Instagram captions.
I don't dance now, I make money move. Say I don't gotta dance, I make money move. If I see you now speak, that means I don't f*** with you. I'm a boss, you a worker, I make bloody move. Now she say she gon' do.
So I just have to shout out Cardi B, Instagram celebrity, former, you know, character or persona or whatever on Love and Hip Hop New York, from the Bronx, now a rapper. Like, that song is popping. Like, the first time I heard it, I was sort of like, eh. But I'm telling you now, it's an earworm. It's in the running. It's in the running is what I'm trying to say.
I'll keep it in the running.
Put it in your rotation.
I'm not a fan, but
I hear you, and I feel like maybe the way you feel about Khalid is kind of how I used to feel about Cardi B, but nah. It's over. She's legit. Like, that song comes on, and every single woman in the room just starts doing, like, a little
Can I tell you something?
What?
I thought that was Iggy Azalea the first time I heard it.
Shut your face.
I did.
Shut your face.
I was like,
get
she's
out of
back?
Here. No!
Iggy's back?
Oh, my God. Sounds nothing like Iggy. Well, now you know. Cardi B, 24. Fierce, amazing. Known for such truisms such as when asked about global warming, says a hoe never gets cold. I mean, she's just a pot of gold at the end of the rainbow. She's amazing.
Maybe she should have recorded that instead. Okay.
I'm also thinking a lot about toxic masculinity, and there have been a lot of comments made by various people, including our president, about transgendered bodies and transgendered people. And already we're in this mode of what feels like a tinderbox of violence just waiting to happen. You have that viral video of this woman talking to Somali American kids about that they're going to kill all these Muslims. You also have the president talking about police brutality and basically endorsing it. And then you have the president talking about transgender people being a burden. And then you have Charlamagne Tha God on The Breakfast Club basically endorsing the misgendering of Janet Mock and not saying anything when a guest on the show suggests violence against trans people who don't disclose that they're trans. I feel very aggy and I feel very gross inside. And my anxiety is ratcheting up, and I'm just deeply worried about what's going on in this state of the country. And I don't condone any of this violence or any of these suggestions of violence. And I feel like we may not be able to talk about it in this show, but it's something we all have to keep in the back of our minds, and just the ways in which we can be more accommodating to people who are not like us. We can be more accommodating in our workplaces. We can be more advocates. We can go on GLAAD's website for suggestions on how to advocate for a gender neutral restroom. I mean, there's a lot of things that we can do in our day-to-day lives to make other people's lives easier that are huge priority. Mm-hmm. But I'm deeply distressed.
Yeah.
Deeply, deeply, deeply distressed right now.
So this administration is doing some crazy stuff to our brains. Mm-hmm. It is continuing to do crazy stuff to the country. It has got us keyed up in ways that we previously were not. And it has put us on alert for all kinds of offenses and affronts. And they're all legitimate. This guy never stops. You never know what you're going to get from him.
Ever.
You never know who in the administration is going to have a job.
It's so high key. We're on high alert.
And we kind of should be, because we have been living in a time during which the people who supported Donald Trump, for instance, were very much interested in combating what they saw as a kind of political correctness.
Mm.
Conversely, there is a real effort underway, and it's been underway for years, to make political corrections when they're needed.
To the historical record.
Right. To the historical record, to the living record. I mean, we're talking about removing Confederate signs from places like New Orleans. We're talking about removing slave owners' names from college campuses.
Right.
Which is what happened to Calhoun College, Yale University, where I went. All of these energies are sort of tempesting around each other. And one of those tempests has boiled over this summer. You have the controversy over this HBO show, Confederate, which has not even been made yet.
It has just been announced. Just a press release went out. Just a press release went out, which also, like, you know, next time do better, guys. Don't put out a press release about a show called Confederate. Anyway, continue.
So you've got that. And then you have this question of whether or not Kathryn Bigelow and Mark Bull, a white woman filmmaker and a white male screenwriter, whether they should have made Detroit, which is set during the 1967 Detroit riots. and features a predominantly black cast, although you need racist police officers, so they're played by white people. And then the controversy that is still not dead over Dana Schutz, her painting of Emmett Till that was at featured in the Whitney Biennial,
mm-hmm.
and the questions around whether or not she had the right to paint it, or not so much even whether she had the right to paint it, but what the Whitney Museum's responsibility to its public were in displaying it,
right.
and exhibiting
That's
it, and
right.
including it in the Whitney Biennial. So with that being the kind of summer we're having, with this movie opening this weekend, it's going wider this weekend, with Confederate people still fighting over that. People are now using
protesting it during Game of Thrones! Hashtag no Confederate, which HBO is just like, doesn't care about.
So what we should try to talk about is the question of who's right and who's wrong?
The thing is, what we have to talk about, though, is why these items are flashpoints right now. Because mm-hmm. this is not a new dilemma.
It's not new.
This is not a new problem. It's particularly poignant right now because we are having all these discussions around PC culture, anti-PC culture, political discourse. We also live in a time of hyper commentary in real time and never ending. Whereas, I mean, we live in a time where HBO has to pay attention to a hashtag started on Twitter about a show that is still a twinkle in its creators' minds. I think it's a very exciting dialogical time between creators and consumers that we've never seen before.
No.
And so we may not be able to figure out who's right and who's wrong, but at least we can figure out why everyone's so feisty over it all. And I think there's a lot to unpack there about what the feelings are that are coming up around a painting by one artist at a moment in time that may not be remembered to the grandiose scale of art history, and a movie at a point in time that is trying to show something about police brutality when we're still very much living in that moment.
We have no promise to have any questions answered. All we can do is promise to try to work them out. So when we come back, we're going to have a conversation focused primarily around the Confederate Detroit question. And then we'll just sort of push out a little bit and like talk about the history, like a brief history of this problem, and then what institutions and capitalist entities or corporate entities, what responsibility they have in either delimiting it or having it proliferate. And it is not an absolute yes or no answer to the question of like, who does X person get to do why because of their race. We'll be right back.
This podcast is supported by Washington.org. Washington, D.C. offers visitors so much to explore. Just ask Dayo, who shared her experiences from a recent visit.
What was your favorite food all weekend?
The Ethiopian food at Sihei.
And the first place you would visit again?
The bookstore, Little District Books.
What did you appreciate the most?
Really just like the genuine kindness of everyone that I encountered this weekend.
Why should people visit D.C.?
Well, D.C. is a place with such a thriving culture.
Washington, D.C. has something for everybody. Plan your next trip at Washington.org.
I'm Emily Badger. I'm a reporter with The New York Times. Since the pandemic, empty office buildings have become much more common in many cities. Why can't we just turn them into housing? It's actually a really complicated question. To answer this question, you have to find a developer trying to turn an office building into apartments. Ride a rickety elevator to the 30th floor of a construction site to see the interior guts of a building. Finds an expert in incandescent light bulbs who can explain to you how they fundamentally change office buildings. And that's just the beginning of what you have to do. When you subscribe to The New York Times, you are sending reporters like me out into the world to ask questions of dozens of different experts, to go and visit places most people don't get to go, to try to come back with answers, and then turn all of that into something that anyone can understand. If you'd like to become a subscriber, head to nytimes.com/subscribe. You need to see the animated floor plans in this piece.
There are a lot of things we want to talk about. Let's also just break it down, though, what happened when. Because there's a lot we want to touch on, but let's just sort of like lay it out.
So March 16th, the Whitney Biennial opens. It features Dana Schutz's open casket, a painting of Emmett Till from the waist up laying horizontally in the casket. Protests erupt. There was an artist who showed up many, many days.
The artist, Parker Bright, shows up with a shirt that says in the back, handwritten, Black Death Spectacle, and just stands in front of the work during the show.
And then July 19th, fast forward. This went on all summer, by the way, these back and forths. Mm-hmm. Zadie Smith wrote a piece basically expressing a sort of bafflement at the response because a group of artists, including a woman named Hannah Black, wrote a petition, gave it to the Whitney that basically called for not simply the removal of the painting, but its destruction.
Correct.
Not only should it not have been made, it no longer needs to exist. That began this series of responses from people like Zadie Smith, who were very thoughtful on the matter of what Dana Schutz should be able and allowed to do as a white woman painting about a critical aspect of the Black experience. But I would also say that it's not just the Black experience, it's the American experience. And this is one of the things we're going to have to talk about, too, in terms of who gets to say and do what.
Of course.
July 19th.
HBO announces a show called Confederate from two showrunners, Game of Thrones. Game of Thrones is winding down, so in theory, people are interested. What are they going to do next? So they're excited, but this is what they're working on, which is very confusing. HBO says in a press release, the show will chronicle the events leading up to the Third American Civil War. Okay, takes place in an alternative timeline. Southern states have seceded successfully from the Union, giving rise to a nation in which slavery remains legal and has evolved into a modern institution. So in their description of what the show will contain, there's going to be a Mason-Dixon demilitarized zone. There'll be freedom fighters, slave hunters, politicians, abolitionist journalists, the executive slaveholding conglomerate, and families of the people in Northrail. So after this press release goes out, people on Twitter go nuts, including a woman named April Rain, who was the person behind Oscar So White hashtag movement, and essentially says, we want HBO to cancel the show and make a different set of series that uplift and showcase marginalized voices.
All right, we'll come back to that. But the next day,
the very next day,
there were 9 concerned protesters who had written to the Institute of Contemporary Art in Boston, which was on the verge of opening a Dana Schutz show. The show had been in the works for 2 years. They had written to the ICA to basically get them to reconsider exhibiting her work. Open Casket is not featured in the show, but nonetheless, they feel that Dana Schutz, just showing her work at all, is an affront to not only artists of color, but people of color, and poses a real problem for the city of Boston. Their exact wording in their 6-page letter was they wanted to discuss the implications of this exhibit on the community, on the Boston community.
Okay, and then a few days later on July 26th, the Schutz Show opens in Boston. Detroit also opens in New York and LA. And there are a lot of mixed reactions to it. One review called it cathartic. A critic at RogerEbert.com essentially said that this movie was a travesty, but not for the reasons portrayed in the film, but because they never want to see a white gaze on black paint ever again, sparking this debate about who gets to make what film and whether or not Kathryn Bigelow and Mark Bull had the right to make this movie to begin with, or would it have been in better, more capable hands, I'm using air quotes here, capable hands, in the hands of a black director and a producer. So that's where we are. I mean,
stuff feels like it's about to start burning.
Start popping off. They're about to pop off, as Brock said. We miss you, Barry.
That's a lot.
It's a lot.
The thing that makes it a lot is it meets up with, in all of these different ways, a whole history of moments in which the question of whether or not a white person can accurately, sufficiently, fairly, not just see from the point of view of an oppressed people, but whether or not that person, that white artist, director, producer, studio, etc., whether that white infrastructure should be able at all to tell the stories of non-white people without the participation of a member of that race, the prominent participation of a member of that race.
And it always feels like the obvious answer should just be like, well, yeah, anyone can make a film about anything. I mean, in theory, right? Like anyone sort of could tackle a topic or tackle a subject or make a piece of art or a film or write a book or whatever about another person's experience that should be able to be fully and totally rendered. But at the same time, that's also assuming that the creator is aware of their own unconscious biases or their own lens or their own racialized ideas or stereotypes that they may not be super tapped into themselves, that they then project onto this narrative that reinforce mm-hmm, caricatures, mm-hmm, that mm-hmm. reinforce stereotypes. And I think when we were watching Detroit, I was deeply, deeply, deeply uncomfortable with how many lingering shots there were on people looting, close-up shots of black skin that wasn't really that well rendered. Like, you couldn't really see the skin very well, which says something about who's doing the shooting, that they're not familiar with shooting darker skin tones. There are lots of moments where you see black men talking with white women, and the camera work makes it feel vaguely threatening. I mean, there are lots of things that are happening that are reinforcing this or making you sort of project this idea that blackness is threatening onto the screen. Mm-hmm. And so when you're doing that couched within a larger film about that's trying to take down our eradicator or throw attention to or light on police brutality, when you watch the police going through Detroit under siege, you're kind of worried about the police's safety. And so when you find yourself
the D.W. Griffith Birth of a Nation trick where you're rooting for the KKK pesky, awful, demonic, mutant, dehumanized slaves.
Right. And so for me, it's less of a question about should she have made this film. It's more of a question, well, can you separate your own white gaze from the subject matter enough to be able to tell it without doing all the things, falling into all the trappings that so many films about blackness already fall into?
I was very struck by who the movie was interested in, like which characters the movie was interested in. Two of the characters are these two white women who were at the hotel looking for fun,
hoping
to get lucky with these Negroes running around. And they do. But at the same time, they wind up hostages
alongside
in this house. And I was uncomfortable with the choice, like with having to sit through a movie called Detroit, but really set in a hallway, as far as I can tell.
Right. It could have been anywhere.
It could have been anywhere. Yeah. It's just set in the back of some staircase
in
a couple of rooms, but it's called Detroit.
Right.
It was annoying to me that they found the characters they found interesting.
Clearly in this film, they're searching for some meaning. They're searching for a way to get us to care about this thing that happened at this particular point in time and relate it to where we are in 2017. But it doesn't quite translate. Like, the film never manages to successfully kind of make you... I mean, you care about police brutality, sure, but you don't really ever see yourself fully, I feel anyway, like what... Which character do you empathize with the most, or which one do you align yourself with the most? And I don't know that you walk out of there aligned with any of them. So what gets lost in translation for this movie, or why was this so hard for them to map on the universal human experience onto the lives of these black men?
Because ultimately they make movies about bureaucrats and soldiers. And in this case, they can't find a bureaucrat or soldier like that's really interesting and to me worth caring about. But really, the most interesting people in the movie are the cops.
Of course.
So we know that Detroit doesn't work. We know that it doesn't work in very particular ways. But we also know that in some ways, one of the things that you don't quite think is working is the point of view of the movie itself. Firstly, because it doesn't really have one, but also because it continues to do a lot of what a lot of these movies do, which is to only see black people in terms of their relationship with the police, in terms of
whiteness,
in terms of whiteness, but also those guys in the hotel aren't really that interesting to the movie until these white women become involved in the story too.
And really, the juxtaposition of how the white women are treated as brutally as the men, more or less, kind of serves the purpose of, well, if they're willing to do that to white women, then my God, you know, and they're animals.
Right.
And that's when you know the film is wonky. Like, that's actually when you know the film is wonky. But I had this feeling halfway through the film, towards the end of the film, I should say, actually, if you're a well-to-do or well-meaning white person and you're trying to shed light on a criminal injustice and you have a platform like Kathryn Bigelow and you have the attention of that name, you have the Oscars behind you. I mean, do we just accept this as her kind of, you know, social justice warrior offering because no one else is taking that on? I mean, I don't know. Like, I felt really desperate at the end of the movie because there's very much still a context for brutality and death at the hand of the police. And even with more documentation, like, we actually happen to know that even if you have video footage, if you have body cam footage, it does not lead to a conviction. So we go from a hypothetical scenario where, well, we don't know what happened to actual real life concrete scenarios where, yeah, in 2017, oftentimes we know what happened and it still doesn't matter. The police still aren't convicted when they brutalize black bodies that they have in custody. They abuse their power all the time, nonstop. So then you have someone like Kathryn Bigelow who's like, I'm going to try to put light on this and bring it to the forefront and bring it to the consciousness. I don't want to fault her for that, as flawed as it is. But then I feel like I'm begging for table scraps.
But this is where it meets up with all this other stuff, right? This is the fight that we're having over Dana Schutz. and this one painting, and now her entire career, basically, now. And this is also the question that you have to ask about a work like Confederate, which, in theory, because we don't know, it doesn't exist yet, could it do all of those things that you were hoping and expecting Kathryn Bigelow's movie to do, right? What problem does it set out for itself, and how does it solve that problem? And is the Game of Thrones model one that you want to see applied to slavery? I don't know. I feel like there's got to be some criteria by which to determine
absolutely
whether these works are, like, quote, allowed, unquote, to live or die.
Well, part of that criteria also has to be one of density, right? Like, part of the reason that mm-hmm. people are upset about a show like Confederate is because HBO, they have not historically done a great job of showcasing Black life outside of crisis, outside of tragedy, outside mm-hmm. of mm-hmm. dire straits and pain. So I think part of the outrage comes from, if you're going to invest a Game of Thrones-like budget into a show about Black people, if you're choosing to, you know, prey on a fantasy that a lot of people, frankly, still have in this country. Like, you can't avoid the fact that we are living under administration where a lot of people would not be mad if there were Confederate flags everywhere. If there was, you know what I mean? That's what they want. I mean,
how
that's,
often do we hear somebody still say, you know, I think they'd be better off as slaves?
You know what I mean? So I think that's part of the criteria, though, is under what circumstances is this work existing? Is it a work in which there are lots of other alternatives to the version of Black life that it's presenting, or not?
But it does strike me as peculiarly privileged to use it like a term I hate for these two guys to dream up this story. And now, since the controversy is heated up, mm-hmm. they have found two other Black people who are involved with the making of the
show.
Like, who are producers. Those people at that line level never get credit for anything when a show doesn't even exist yet. And so now they're being trotted out, not unwisely.
I was going to say that. I was like, I thought better of using the word trot out, but they are.
They're being trotted out.
And they said in a statement, so there's two producers, Nichelle Spellman and Malcolm Spellman, who are working on the show, and they said, the four of us are very thoughtful, very serious, and not flip about what we're getting to in any way, .. I would have loved an opportunity for the conversation to start once the show is on the air. Now, you and I texted about this article back and forth. The one thing we both noticed that was missing from all of this is why? But why do you want to tell the story? And why are you interested mm-hmm. in it? We can't really work with speculation, and we can't work with the hypothetical, but tell us more about what you hope to achieve. But we don't know that.
Right. They're asking us, and this is the crazy
thing. To trust them.
Can you imagine if Dana Schutz had to deal with a press release about a painting she hadn't even remotely begun to do yet? And the outrage was so intense, you try to shut her down before she even starts. I'd rather just get the work and deal with the work. And if you think you have something to say about slavery in 2017, bring it. Let me see what you got. But where we are right now is we don't even want things that get made that run into this problem to exist anymore. The outrage over Dana Schutz it's officially reached the point with this ICA show that she shouldn't even be exhibited anymore.
They want to erase her. She needs to go away. I think the protests are important, and I think they're valid, and I think I don't think any artist should be erased because they make work that's controversial whatsoever. But I also think that the response to it does illuminate a bigger deficit or a bigger feeling of lack of attention that's paid. I mean, it's the exact same thing that happens in Detroit. People are mad because they don't understand why this work of art gets so much attention when so many other works of art don't get any attention that also look at Black life that is not necessarily about this particular incident in time. I mean, I think that is, that's again, that's like the politics of scarcity. It's like people feel like there aren't enough Black artists who get to make work about just regular Black life. You know, like you have an artist. I see you rolling your eyes. I'm not saying this is my point of view. I'm just saying that this is the argument.
I'm hearing what you're saying and I'm thinking. And like one of my responses to this whole outcry over Open Casket is it completely short circuits the other paintings that are in the biennial
that
speak to the modern problem of, I don't know, Henry Taylor had a piece in the Biennial of Philando Castile that was eerily reminiscent of another paint. I mean, it had a very sort of Kerry James Marshall feel
yes,
to it.
Yes, absolutely.
The piece was called The Times They Ain't Changing Fast Enough. And it is similar in some ways to Open Casket, but more imaginative in a sense. Philando Castile is a living being. He is either in an afterlife or a life before the incident that took his life. And basically making Dana Schutz a negative star is almost as troublesome to me as not celebrating Henry Taylor
for his work. Or Dana Lawson, who also had a catalog of amazing, gorgeous photographs.
It was a rich show.
It was a very rich show.
And black bodies, black life matter to it. This gets us into a question of the sort of metapolitics versus the work itself. I would say in the case of Open Casket, it is an unsuccessful painting on its own terms. But I actually think she's a really good artist generally. I think the failure of this painting is that it actually is a failed attempt at empathy.
Well, that's
I think her work generally sort of has a much bigger scope to it.
Right.
And this is not her first painting about death, but its intimacy is cold to me.
There's a bit of a cognitive dissonance from when you're looking at the painting because it is rendered in various abstract forms, and there's a moment of looking at it and trying to understand what you're looking at, and then the moment of realization is what distances you from the work.
Right.
The moment
right.
of realization, right. what you're looking at, this interpretation of a mangled face that's represented by like a smear of paint,
right.
and who it's supposed to
it's
be.
It's a literal gesture.
It's a literal gesture. Yeah. And I think that's, to me, what made it unsuccessful, embedded within all these other works about
there
black life.
Also, the point for me is, are we talking about the quality of a painting? Are we even allowed to talk about the quality of the painting or the quality of Detroit? Or if God forbid, Confederate is good, what do we do with that? Can it even be good at this
point? Can it even be good?
And what would good even mean?
I'm like deeply skeptical that it's even going to come out. I feel like the amount of backlash even before this thing comes out is going to...
So I ultimately think they should be allowed to do it and just have it speak to HBO's politics, to the creators' politics, to their interests. It says something to me that these two people want to spend their vast Game of Thrones capital on this show. And what upsets me about it is that I don't know how you could think this wouldn't upset people.
We live in a society that still disempowers black people, where we're still recovering from the legacy of slavery. There's still a lot of institutional racism in place that's started with the institution of slavery. And so there is a possibility for a thoughtful commentary on that. We don't know. The HBO has made some great shows. We don't know what they're trying to do.
Right.
But the fact that we still don't know what they're trying to do is evident that maybe they don't know what they're trying to do, and that certainly no one was really thinking that deeply about what the response would be, which I think is part of the problem that we're trying to talk about here.
Craft matters in small ways, like how coffee is made or how a wooden table is built piece by piece, and in not so small ways, like how your money is cared for. At UBS, we elevate investing to a craft. We deliver our services with passion, expertise, and meticulous attention to detail. This is what investing means to UBS. Not just work, but a craft. Discover more at ubs.com/craft. The value of investments may fall as well as rise, and you may not get back the amount originally invested.
I'm Emily Badger. I'm a reporter with the New York Times. Since the pandemic, empty office buildings have become much more common in many cities. Why can't we just turn them into housing? It's actually a really complicated question. To answer this question, you have to find a developer trying to turn an office building into apartments, ride a rickety elevator to the 30th floor of a construction site to see the interior guts of a building, find an expert in incandescent light bulbs who can explain to you how they fundamentally change office buildings. And that's just the beginning of what you have to do. When you subscribe to the New York Times, you are sending reporters like me out into the world to ask questions of dozens of different experts, to go and visit places most people don't get to go, to try to come back with answers, and then turn all of that into something that anyone can understand. If you'd like to become a subscriber, head to nytimes.com/subscribe. You need to see the animated floor plans in this piece.
So we're back, and we've just spent a long time arguing, not arguing, but just heatedly discussing a couple of very important cultural products that were made by white people that are, or will be made by white people in theory, trying to deal with very particular aspects of the Black experience mm-hmm. and our discomfort around it. But look, the way the numbers shake out, the odds are always in their favor. There are always probably going to be more white people taking on the Black experience, and we can't speculate about motives. We can't speculate about intentions, really, other than to say that this is something that is so of our time that maybe if you are a white filmmaker slash artist slash musician slash whatever, you feel you have to grapple with these parts of the American experience because it's coming up and it's evoking something in you, and maybe you're well-meaning and you've got a lot of extra empathy and you want to put your, you know, you want to use some of your power for good. So where do we go from here? I mean, I think this question that we're dancing around is not necessarily who gets to make what and why, but what does it mean to try to do something successfully? Like, do we have any examples? I mean, are most examples just total failures?
I'm much more interested in some ways in the attempt. And I think that the problem for me isn't so much that white people can't have feelings. I mean, the whole thing we've been arguing about before this period was that white people weren't engaged enough with the problem of race. And they didn't have enough feelings about, like, what Black people deal with, suffer
yeah.
on a daily basis. And now we have, I'm not going to call it a proliferation of such culture, but I mean, the Drive-By Truckers put out an album last year. It was called American Band and explicitly dealt with the Black experience, so to speak.
He was running down the street when they shot him in his tracks. About the only thing agreed upon is he ain't coming back. There won't be any trial, so the air won't be clear. There's just two sides calling names out of anger, out of fear. And if you say it wasn't racial when they shot him in his tracks, well, I guess that means that you ain't Black. It means that you ain't Black. I mean, Barack Obama won, and you can choose where to eat. You don't see too many white kids lying bleeding on the street.
It is fair to be suspicious of everybody. It is completely
yes.
fair. You'd be a fool if you weren't.
Can I just say something really quickly, though?
Yes.
You just encapsulated the problem, okay? If you're the Drive-By Truckers and you're most interested in capturing the Black experience, maybe that's the problem, because you're still not thinking about yourself as white. You're still obsessing with Blackness.
Well,
so think about whiteness.
Right.
No, but think about whiteness
right, no,
complicit
you were
in
correct.
Creating Blackness.
I should have reframed that, because that is exactly correct. The thing about that project to me that was so interesting was it was white Southerners thinking about Black people as white people and not as racists. Right? I don't know that the album really worked. I mean, it's very specific in its imagery, but it is a real attempt at looking at Black people as a white person looking at Black people. And that is the thing that we're actually kind of missing, right?
There's
a degree to which the biggest movie of the year, we're going to return to it yet again, is Get Out. And the thing
absolutely.
That it identifies and the reason it keeps coming the F up is because it pinpoints something that white people have denied has existed at all, which is liberal racism, which is like good white people doing racist stuff that they don't think is racist because it doesn't involve a Confederate flag, and it doesn't involve having a great-great-grandfather who was a slave owner, and it doesn't involve voting for Donald Trump. The language around how we talk about this has focused almost exclusively on one type of white person. And this year it has shifted.
Mm.
It isn't just Jeff Sessions.
Yeah.
It's your father-in-law.
It's your friendly local neighborhood.
It's the family you married
person.
Into.
Yeah.
And I think that one of the things that we're really dealing with now in terms of white representation of Black
anything
is the awareness that you are implicated in that, because that's not what was happening before.
Yeah.
Before you get people like Rob Reiner making movies about Medgar Evers' death from the point of view of the lawyer fighting for Merle Evers in the trial. And the best thing in the movie is James Woods' depiction of the racist who shot him. So I do think that there is a shift in terms of not so much how these filmmakers identify as white filmmakers, because that's the thing that I think you're right is missing. These people still don't think of themselves as white,
yes,
the way we
yes,
think of ourselves
yes,
as black. Right?
Absolutely.
And,
which is why they most clearly identify with black paint, I think, or
yes,
historical moments, because it's the easiest to sort of, I think so. I think
but
it's
isn't
the easiest.
It also the fact that like they are the source of that pain?
Right.
And
they're
that's
not acknowledging
the guilt,
it.
Right.
There's the lack of indictment, the lack of willingness to take the next step and really process what that means.
What does it mean for a person like Steven Spielberg, who takes a movie like, who takes a book like The Color Purple, turns it into a film that lots of black people like and have no superficial problem with? What does it mean to love that movie? And can you tell that a white person made it?
We all know a white person made it. It just goes it goes back to hashtag table scraps. We take it because, no, but for a lot
no, no, no,
of people.
Right. In 1985.
That is a real representation
yes,
of black girlhood and black femininity. And there are parts of it that are uncomfortable to watch. And there are parts of it that speak to the black female experience in uncomfortable ways. And when you don't have anything else, you'll take what you can get. And
right,
that's what we're looking at. But I also think there's another shift that's happened as well, right? Two things are happening. One, we have a hyper awareness of how everybody feels at every single moment, right? Like before, if you didn't like The Color Purple, who cares? Throw the newspaper out. You don't have to read the reviews. No one's coming after you. No one's sending pizzas to your house and harassing you about it on Twitter. You're not getting at replied. No one cares. Now you know right away how people feel about something, and you have to wrangle with those opinions. You have to be held accountable. And I think that's an interesting difference of a word versus censorship, right? And I think people are trying to move towards that as sort of the thing they're hanging this around, which is that we're going to hold you accountable to what it means to promote this artist, for what it means to make this movie. I'm not saying you have to listen to everyone's opinions, but you do have to pay attention to them in a way, or you don't have to act on everyone's opinions because people have an opinion about everything. But you do... There is a way in which, like, yeah, like HBO now has to deal with this Twitter campaign that's going to be going on every Sunday until the end of Game of Thrones, or people are pissed off. I actually don't know why the hashtag is hashtag no Confederate. It should be hashtag Game of Thrones. Infiltrate the stream, people.
Right.
Like, from my brain to yours, infiltrate the stream. But I'm just saying, at this point, we have a proliferation of opinions. We also have a proliferation of a lot of really meaningful and interesting and evocative and super, super, super introspective black art.
Yes.
But we didn't have that before.
Right.
So we do have examples of things like Get Out that do raise this question.
Well, we have had this version of black art, but it was cordoned off as black music. And now what we used to call in the 70s black music, your Stevie Wonders, your Parliaments, your music, right? But now that black music is, I mean, it was in the 70s, but now we can only acknowledge it as being only American music and being pop music. And that means that white people, more than they were in the 70s, are so much more aware of the content of such music. And we co-own all of this stuff. And there's a way in which only some fingerprints are going to unlock that code, right? And you might think that yours is good enough to do it as a white person, but it probably isn't.
Especially if you are someone who has not grappled with your own identity and you
yes,
haven't grappled
yes,
with the ways in which
yes,
your people have taken away humanity and dignity from the people you're trying to represent. Like, I'm not saying Kathryn Bigelow isn't a good white person. She very well might be. I don't know her. But I'm just saying that making a movie about police brutality that puts you in a position where you have sympathy for the chief of police who's trying to wrangle these guys is not a very effective way to make a film about police brutality, because what you end up with is a situation where viewers can go like, well, they did their best. And to me, that's insufficient. So I do feel like we need more black people in the rooms. We need more non-black POCs in the room. We need more people who have the ability to say, like, it would be more interesting or maybe more provocative if you rendered this way, or if you thought about this scene. And it just feels like we don't have that.
Right. Okay. So to this point, I would just like to quote Henry Taylor, who did the Philando Castile painting that was at the Whitney. He was asked in Culture, the sort of art and architecture culture magazine, by Hamza Walker about Dana Schutz and whether or not he found the attention that she got upstaging to his work. The gist of his speaking right now, but when what I'm about to read is in response to the notion of white creation. And basically, he says, I remember cutting that out of the newspaper. He's talking about Bob Dylan's song about George Jackson. And he was surprised that Bob Dylan could have written that song. You know, he thought it worked and he thought it was powerful. And so he asks, should Dylan not have written that song about Reuben Hurricane Carter, which is another, which is the hurricane, a different Bob Dylan song. Should Dylan not have written about Hattie Carroll? So that's what I asked myself when Dana did that painting of Emmett Till. People always talk about, when is white America going to come to terms or whatever with their history? I don't know. Is that a start? When I was at the Whitney, I talked to Dana. There was no controversy then. I was just happy to meet her. I like Dana, but I think it has to do with sincerity. Like when I did Sean Bell, a New Yorker who was killed in a hail of bullets by New York police officers. But that effing hit me. Maybe as a mother, she really felt, you know, empathy for this person, you know? We're all on the same page that there, to the degree that we're permitting anybody to do anything,
yeah,
the permission stands. Two things matter ultimately. One is the infrastructure that allows everybody to do everything, right? We could be sitting here having this conversation about why there aren't enough Asian people doing X, Y, or Z.
Mm-hmm.
Why
mm-hmm.
aren't there more mm-hmm. Native Americans doing
mm-hmm.
anything?
Mm-hmm. Indigenous anything,
Why aren't there more queer people who are just out making stuff about day-to-day queer life? More trans people, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
We could go on forever.
This isn't...
The playing field is not even. This is part of the reason why the outrage is so high.
Open the floodgates on the infrastructure.
Yes!
Thing number one. Right, but it's easy for me to say that.
No,
but one group controls the floodgates.
Yes, that's what it comes down to.
So...
Sorry to interrupt, but it's not just one group. It's one group's comfort level, one group's set of preferences, one group's set of interests, one group's priority, one group's... aversion to what they perceive as risk.
As threat, financial risk.
Yeah.
But also as identity threat.
Absolutely.
And that is the thing that we do not talk enough about.
Ever.
Which is the underpinning of our current government administration, the current president and the people who support him, to some extent feel threatened by Issa Rae.
By everyone else. No, it's not even, it's everyone else.
Yes, yes.
It's Issa, but it's all
just
the
temp. I was throwing a rock.
I know you were, but I'm just saying, it's like, throw a rock. Yeah,
so
go on.
Part two.
Okay.
Is the work good? Is it good?
Right.
I think that there's a way you can do it.
Of course.
So that it works.
Absolutely.
But the idea that if you fail once, that your career ends, is insanity to me.
Well, that's a new thing though. That's a new thing because I'm just saying though, that is a new
thing.
But that
is a Trump era thing, right? Because when Robert Mapplethorpe was taking those pictures of those black men in the 1980s and the late 70s, the conversation wasn't about, I mean, it was about black pain and like his capitalization off of it, but he still got exhibited and he won and everything else.
I just want to say one thing though quickly,
yes,
that I think part of what we're talking a little bit about too is how memory has changed, and memory is a lot more collective now. And so if you weren't in the art world when Mapplethorpe was taking those pictures, or you weren't privy to them, or you encountered them and they made you feel weird and you weren't sure why, where would you go to find out about that? Where would you go to talk about it? I mean, we live in an era where what bubbles up in social media becomes objects of national attention, becomes national stories. Like we're tapped into a collectiveness, and we're remembering things a lot more collectively and with a lot more longevity, I think, which is stands in strange. It feels incongruous to considering how much stuff we're consuming on a day-to-day basis. But I think we are influenced more by popular opinion and each other than we have been in a very long time.
Mm-hmm.
For years, if you controversial opinions were published in very particular places, and if you happened to miss them, you probably missed them until you came across them again in college, or someone gave you a book of essays or something that, you know what I mean? There had to have been a system of cultural criticism that found its way to you, or you found your way to it in order to engage with it and have a critical thought that maybe you hadn't encountered before. That's not the case anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So I do think artists are responsible for their entire body of work. I actually think they are. I don't think you should. I mean, you get to do whatever you want to do as many times as you can in your lifetime. I actually fully believe that. But I also think that work is in conversation with itself all the time, and the artist and the whole body. It's true. Like Dana Schutz is now being held accountable because memory is collective. Is that a bad thing? I don't think so. She just has to be able to either decide whether she's going to talk about it or not, or let people speak on her behalf. There's no other way around it. But I think that's good. I think that culturally speaking, that is a very good thing, because ultimately, America's not in the business of saying, ICA is going to let her have her show in Boston. Maybe they'll have some panels around her. They're going to do programming
to bring
in dialogue. Yes, that's the appropriate response. The Whitney hosting tons of panels with Claudia Rankine about the response that work invoked is the right response. The response is not ban her, put her on Shelter Island. It's and that's how we move forward. That's right. How we move forward. No. Is we have these conversations that are then live streamed on Facebook. Anyone can watch. We use the collapsing of distance that social media, as evil as it can be sometimes, has allowed us. Yeah, we collapse time and space in order to allow more people access to having these conversations and their voices to be heard. That's one way forward, in my opinion.
I think the takeaway is we are not going to shake these problems. And I mean, fundamentally, we belong to each other.
And we're accountable to each other.
Yeah.
And America, like, that's the thing we're finally figuring out.
Guess that's our show again.
No real answers, but hopefully some entertainment along the way.
Still Processing is a product of the New York Times. It's produced by Jenna Weiss-Berman and Harry Malofsky and Ricky Novetsky and Max Linsky from Pineapple Street Media.
Our editor is Sasha Weiss. We also have editorial oversight from Lisa Tobin and Samantha Hennig.
And our theme music is by Kindness. It's called World Restart from the album Otherness.
You can find all of our episodes and various things at nytimes.com/stillprocessing. And if you like what you hear, leave us a review on iTunes.
Guys, we heard you on transcripts.
We're working to make our show a lot more accessible for our hearing impaired listeners. That's a big priority for us.
So we'll keep you updated.
We'll keep you updated. We also have a little bit of personal news, which is that Still Processing is taking a brief hiatus.
We'll be back August 24th. It's going to be great.
I guess we're technically going on vacation. We're going to work together in New Orleans at the National Association of Black Journalists conference this year, but mostly we'll just be offline.
All right, we'll see you guys in a couple weeks.
Bye.